Hello and welcome back, listeners. Today we have on Kevin Kozari, who is a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute, where he studies U.S. Congress, congressional oversight, administrative state, American politics, and the U.S. Postal Service. The main thing we will be talking about today is his new book that came out just last year. Congress overwhelmed, the decline in congressional capacity and prospects for reform. And Congress is always a fascinating topic that I've researched over the years, so I hope you enjoy it as much as I do.
All right. So the first question I always like to ask, and what is the reasoning why you made the book, and the context, of why it matters today? So what is the reasoning? Why does it matter, and why should people care, about Congress?
Well, I guess I would start from the last of your questions, which is, Congress by constitutional design is supposed to be the heart of our federal republic. It's the most democratic, lowercase d, of our institutions. Anybody, any citizen or even non-citizen, can reach out to their member of Congress and give them input on governing, bring problems to their attention. Et cetera, et cetera. But we know that public approval of Congress has been abysmal, historically abysmal. Now, it's worth noting that, it's very rare for Congress to be adored by 75% of the population. That's just not the way things tend to work. And it's due to the nature of the institution, which is it's a place where there's a lot of politicking and bargaining and things that the American public generally doesn't like to watch. But the levels of public approval for Congress right now are just astonishingly low. They've been hovering between like 10 and 20%. And that's been going on for the better part of 2 decades. And that sort of trough, that low level of public opinion, is genuinely concerning because it raises the possibility of just a legitimacy crisis. Why obey? Well, you obey because you respect the institutions. Well, a lot of people don't respect the institution. And so the book was aimed to try to think differently about congressional reform. I think it's very common in this country when we think about congressional reform to kind of go one of 2 ways. You either think at the individual level, like we need better people in Congress, the people who are there now are subhuman in some way or inadequate, they have the wrong value or whatever, or they're corrupt. Or we think at the party level, well, if we just throw the Democrats out, we'll have a better day. That doesn't really work. We've seen plenty of good people come into Congress and, things have not much changed. We've also seen partisan control of Congress pinball back and forward since the 1990s at a faster rate than it has since the post-Civil War days. And things aren't getting better. And so the book is a way of saying, let's think differently about this. Let's think about Congress as an institution and ask ourselves some basic questions about, as an institution, is it structured in ways that enable it to do what the public expects of it?
Yeah, I really want to talk about the framework that you use to analyze Congress. You draw a distinction between the effects of polarization and the effects of decreasing congressional capacity. If somebody was to critique this framework, couldn't they say, in a certain sense, it's a distinction without a difference? As if you have an increasingly polarized political climate, you're going to have perverse incentive structures, which then lead to Congress members individually, in the institution in general, to neglect the resources an organization needed for congressional capacity. Or if you don't think it's a distinction without a difference, what do you think are some capacities of Congress that you can say atrophied because of forces independent of polarization?
Yeah, no, it's a very good question. And I think there's definitely an interplay that one can see between the partisan polarization and the incapacitation of Congress that has happened in various ways. I guess one thing I would say where you could separate these two kind of explanations for what's wrong with Congress and say that they're not simply just different words for the same darn thing, effectively, is that we know that Congress, if you read the work of James Curry and Francis Lee, Congress actually does move legislation in a bipartisan fashion. Not everything is rammed through along partisan lines with the help of reconciliation. And how does that happen? How does Congress actually get some stuff done? Well, there are a lot of issues that just aren't polarized. You know, the big legislation the other year to put a whole bunch of money towards, you know, the national park system and to just revamp the statute around it and et cetera, really hard for one side or the other to demagogue on that sort of issue. And so they ground through the, you know, give and take and negotiation and all that sort of stuff, and they got that bill through. They also got through a big crime bill because the crime issue has kind of moved to a different place than it was in the 1990s when there was this fear of super predators and all that sort of stuff going on, and the kind of lock them up chant was a big thing. So Congress can get stuff done. Congress does have some capacity, but it tends to be on these lower salience issues. And the higher salience stuff, you know, yeah, unfortunately, what happens with the higher salience stuff is that it feeds decisions that often lead to congressional decapacitation. For example, leadership, giving more and more power over the daily operations of the chamber and the agenda setting to leaders. You know, the idea, unfortunately, in a lot of members of Congress's minds is, wow, we're at war with those other guys. We need to unite, and we need to unite behind one person in the chamber. That's the leader.
Yep.
And so they simply defer. And they say, well, that person can call up the bills and we'll just try to be good soldiers as best we can. Well, in the course of doing that, they're giving away their own ability to have a substantive role in the lawmaking process. And ironically, when the big omnibus comes through and it's being pushed along partisan lines, they then throw up their hands and say, we never got a chance to read the bill. We never got a chance to have input. And it's like, well, that's because you gave your power away.
Yeah, did consolidating leadership, I mean, the story that's always told that when Republicans finally took back the House with Gingrich in the 90s, that this was really when leadership started to consolidate more power. Is it more complex than that, or is that the basic gist of the story?
It goes back even a little bit further. At the end of the 1970s, there was a minority leader in the House, Republican, I'm blanking on his name, unfortunately, who did something novel. He decided that the GOP, despite being in the minority, needed to put out what amounted to as a platform. Like, this is what we stand for, and this is what we would do. And this thing was basically the precursor of the type of thing that we got in the 90s with Newt Gingrich and the Contract with America. So at that point in time, you know, you had this, the longest time the Democrats, I mean, they controlled both chambers for something like 50 years, and Republicans got it in their mind that, you know, if you looked at the electorate, it is just naturally the case that there are going to be more Democrats than Republicans. You know, we're kind of the party of businessmen, and there are fewer of those than there are workers, and there's big labor, and they can get out the votes. And therefore, we're the minority party, and we'll just go along and get along, and we'll, you know, win some stuff on the margins, and we'll control the liberals' excesses. That was the kind of mentality mm-hmm. that they had. But demography was changing, and, you know, it always does change. And, you know, some Republicans started picking it up and saying, let's fight the Democrats. And, you know, one exogenous variable, like who could have predicted, was C-SPAN showing up. Yeah. Cable TV as becoming a thing in America. I mean, when I was a kid, it was being rolled out in Ohio. And it was like, wow, we could have more than the big three channels that we get through the rabbit ears. It's amazing. Well, guess what? C-SPAN creates this venue where members of Congress could do after-hour speeches in front of an empty chamber and trash the other party. And the Republicans did that with relish under Gingrich. And that kind of, you know, one party starts to unite behind one person. The other party is like, well, we better unite behind ours because battle is on. And it feeds that. It creates that dynamic. And it's very hard for them to back down from that and to allow power to go back down.
So this is something I don't quite understand. Does the consolidation of power with leadership, how has that affected changes with the congressional calendar? And you can also leapfrog off of that to talk about if you think there is any issues with the congressional calendar currently.
Yeah, I mean, what got voted on, if we go back to the days of, you know, say the early 70s and before, the congressional calendar, obviously, you know, leaders have the authority to decide what goes on it. But the way they decide it was in much more conversation with the strong committee heads. You know, it was a multi-power system for each party to deal with, each party had to deal with. And, you know, so there would be, you know, a member, powerful committee member, you know, Wilbur Mills or something like that said, this bill's got to get voted on this week. I got it all lined up. Well, you could bet the speaker was going to take that very, very seriously. You know, that dynamic has largely ebbed away. And, you know, committee chairs were selected by the speaker, basically. You know, they go hat in hand. And if the timing is not right, well, the leader says the timing's not right and they have to kind of go back and sit in their corner. And, and that's where we're at. And so it is, you know, that's why so much of what either party does when it takes over the chamber looks a lot like public relations. They have a whole, like, we want to create all sorts of impressions out there amongst our most ardent supporters, amidst the media, amidst the public as a whole. So let's line up bills that we will pass. I don't know if they're going to get through that other chamber, but we're going to pass them in our chamber. Bang, bang, bang. That way we look good to them. It's more public relations than governing. That's one of the effects.
Gotcha. Since we currently have perverse incentive structures that, you know, favor more and more performativity versus substantive legislation and oversight, how would we create new incentive structures that help boost congressional capacity? Because the main metric that people in Congress are always going to measure is if they get reelected in that. So changes in how media covers issues, how political primaries function, gerrymandering, the collapse of political parties like power as an institution, or any other number of things.
Yeah, there are certainly a lot of variables that are exogenous to Congress that one could play with, you know, whether it's single member districts, first past the post voting, you know, the various campaign finance related stuff. I mean, there's all sorts of possibilities there that could aim to alter the election system, which is going to affect the calculus of individuals when they arrive in the chamber. As a legislator, in the book, you know, we mostly deal with what's kind of endogenous to Congress. Mm-hmm. And I guess the first thing that I would point to, and it was based on me spending 11 years at the Congressional Research Service and working directly with legislators and their staff, was widespread individual misery on the Hill. People come down and, you know, there's this feeling of like, this is not what we signed up for. You know, this is just not, I mean, it's one thing to be a little surprised at the way things actually work. It's another thing to be profoundly disappointed and super frustrated. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of super frustrated and upset people on the Hill. And so tapping into that individual angst and seeing if you can get it assembled to demand change within the chamber, you know, that's been what I've been working on the last 6+ years. You know, it's a collective action problem. Everyone's miserable, but nobody knows what to do about it. Nobody, you know, often they're afraid to do something, like, oh, well, you know, we won't be the rabble rousers. And so trying to help them see ways that they can make their individual lives better, like demand better software for dealing with constituents, demand that the 18 staff, personal staff limit be removed so that even if you have the same amount of money, you can, you know, perhaps use more people, but, you know, pay them lower or, you know, use half-time people or et cetera, like, ask for stuff like that. Ask that they put more nerds at the Congressional Research Service and the GAO who can be on hand to help you. Like, ask for stuff. Mm-hmm. And so that's the first thing, to get those that kind of microeconomic calculations to come together so that people can collectively demand, because every one of them has a vote. And if every one of them has a vote, every one of them has a weapon they can use against leadership. You know, leadership can only do so much. And that vote is like the most powerful thing. And that's how we got the Select Committee on the Modernization of Congress a few years ago, is we had a bunch of newly elected people who came to DC, who talked to people who were here already in Congress and miserable. And we, you know, I and others had been, you know, waving our arms for a while about, you guys got to create a Select Committee or a two-chamber committee to work on congressional reform. People withheld their votes for Nancy Pelosi's speakership until she agreed to throw them this bone. You know, that's the sort of thing, that's the way you can affect change. You tap into people's incentives.
So then what is your opinion on the use of congressional detailees from the executive branch to help with capacity? And since you touched on it, what is the importance and the role of nonpartisan organizations like the GAO, CRS, or CBO with oversight and helping out Congress?
Yeah, this gets into a thing that we tend to sort of know about Congress, but we as citizens frequently forget, which is our national legislature, by its very nature, is inherently amateur. It's not run by civil servants who've, you know, had their jobs for 30 years and are, you know, experts in very narrow issue areas like the political economy of Guatemala or something like that. You know, anybody gets elected to Congress, and the turnover in Congress is intense. There's, you know, a lot of new blood coming in, a lot of people getting washed out, retirements and elections, et cetera. You know, somebody who's been a small town mayor, for example, or, you know, a lawyer back in Missouri or some such place, and they come rolling into DC desiring to govern, they don't know where to start. The government is a $4.5 trillion, and this is pre-COVID, $4.5 trillion operation with 180 executive agencies. Like, it's immense. You know, people spend decades becoming experts on things like Medicare. And that's just one policy. So, you know, people roll into Congress, they need help. Now, there are plenty of lobbyists, and there are plenty of people who are part of politically active C4 and other groups who would love to give them help. But they all got an angle. This is where the nonpartisan civil servants and Congressional Research Service, the GAO, Congressional Budget Office, Library of Congress, they're the ones that they can, Congress can count upon to just give them the facts, to act as a kind of institutional memory that can be drawn upon to explain, just like, how does this stuff work?
Mm-hmm. Do you think we need civil service reform then, since, I mean, all the way back to the 19th century when you had the Pendleton Civil Service Reform Act, you could really argue there's been an imbalance, like you were saying, with who has more expertise, and then the people in the executive branch will have longer careers because there's going to be more nonpartisan appointees. Do you think there's any reforms that we can do to either weaken and limit the amount of non-political appointees in the executive or make more permanent staffing positions in Congress?
Yeah. And this does, I mean, it gets to the question you floated out there, which is that Congress has gotten in this habit of relying on detailees from the executive branch, which, it, you know, they certainly can be helpful, but they also tend to go to Congress as agents of the executive branch. They are there by the grace of their, you know, their agency's permission. And, you know, they can be recalled and, you know, they can suffer undue consequences if they do things that the agency looks ill upon. And yeah, you know, right now, you know, the executive branch, most of it is run according to the general schedule, which is like this scheme of job classifications, job levels, you know, steps on each level by which one can get more and more pay. Like if there's this whole logical sort of context that one's career is in if you become a civil servant in the executive branch. Congress doesn't have that. Congressional Research Service is on the general schedule, weirdly enough. GAO is on its own schedule. People in Congress who work for legislators are completely at will. They can be canned any moment. There's no HR department that kind of ensures that people are treated fairly as staffers. And so when you look at congressional staff, we did survey congressional staff, you know, they don't have a clear career path. Their pay has been frozen for at least a dozen years. And the cost of living in DC has skyrocketed. So they are basically getting, you know, less bang for the buck. There's no security in the position whatsoever. There have been issues like sexual harassment. You know, we had a situation where if a member sexually harassed a congressional staffer, the congressional staffer had no legal counsel to go to within the branch. They had to hire a private lawyer. Meanwhile, the member of Congress did have an institutional lawyer who would help them. Like, there are all sorts of things that are screwed up about the employment system in the legislative branch with respect to Congress. And all those things, yeah, need to be upgraded so that people stick around and become really expert in their issue.
Do you think it would be possible, or is it unrealistic to say that you could get staffing positions for like people who would stay on one committee or one policy era? Or is that just too pie in the sky?
You know, that is great that you should mention that, because there was something along that line contemplated in the 1946 Legislative Reorganization Act, where the concept was that committees are the policymaking engines of Congress. They need expertise. Their staff needs longevity. And, you know, oversight and policymaking needs to be bipartisan. So the idea was that permanent staff for the committee would be nonpartisan staff, and they would be, you know, hired with the approval of both the chair and the ranking member. And they tried that system for a limited number of years, and the chairman, who were all Democrats at the time, basically decided, we don't want it that way. And so they chucked that system, because what they wanted was to be able to stack the committees with people who are more under their thumb and controllable, which is too bad. I think there should be more kind of long-term staff on each committee, but the question is, how do we do that? You know, it is still the prerogative of a new incoming chair to simply fire everybody. And we saw that happen a couple of years ago with the Senate Committee on Rules and Administration. You know, a new chairman came in, Richard Shelby, and he was only on the committee head only there for a couple of years, I think. And he just cleaned house. He just thought that there were a lot of people who had been around too long and that he wanted to put his own people in, and boom, all that institutional memory was gone. Yeah, it's a problem.
How much of increasing congressional capacity do you think we can make bipartisan versus how much of it do you think will break down just like with the permanent staff on committees?
Yeah, I think there are definitely some sweet spots. I think both the left and the right realize that legislative branch support agencies do play a pretty vital role. You know, Congressional Research Service, GAO, and all that. And, you know, that is one place. Other places are, you know, like the House has a legislative counsel's office, you know, that helps them with bill drafting, and they're completely swamped. Like, they just don't have enough lawyers to do this stuff. And members of Congress and their staff are not equipped to write stuff in the legalese that you need if you want a bill introduced. So there's another place where for sure. Then you get into other stuff like legislative procedure. I mean, the rules by which stuff get done, I think there's probably appeal to changing some of those rules because they're currently just too many people feel like they're getting pounded on one way or another. So for example, if you look at the way that committees in the House versus committees in the Senate divvy up resources, money, and staff, Senate is way more, you know, egalitarian. Mm-hmm. The way the Dems and the Republicans on any committee share the funding and the staff, how many staff each get. The House is severe. You know, it stinks to be in the minority in the House. It doesn't have to be that way. And realizing that Dems and Republicans are kind of each cycling through being the minority every couple of years, I would say there's probably some appetite for like a little less mutual assured destruction.
Yeah, so talking about oversight, one of the things that fascinated me when I was researching is our current system of inspector generals that are supposed to overview the agencies they're assigned to. And generally speaking, I think there needs to be reform on this. And my basic complaint is many of them don't have enough independent authority because of their appointment methods. And a lot of the times they have to send their reports to their agency head before they actually send them back to Congress. I think obviously with President Trump, when he, I believe he fired some in 2020 over the Ukraine thing. I just think they need more independent authority. What do you think about this issue?
Yeah, I mean, inspectors general, you know, they're kind of cops within agencies, and they can be extraordinarily helpful, particularly to the legislature. And you know, unfortunately, the way the inspector general system has been created, it's kind of ad hocery. You know, mm-hmm. It's not like they decided in 1980 or something to say every agency shall have an inspector general and they all shall be appointed the same way. Instead, it's been chunk by chunk with these inspectors general being created. And yeah, some of the arrangements are not ideal. I mean, I like the 2006 reform of the Postal Service's Inspector General. I mean, it used to be the case that the Inspector General would have to go to the Postal Service to request his budget. Like, talk about hat in hand, talk about subservience. 2006 Act changed that. It made it so that he or she who runs the Inspector General of the Postal Service submits their budget individually to Congress. And then that budget amount is taken out of the Postal Service's pocket. It's a very different dynamic. And it led to, I mean, I saw it because I was on the Hill 2003 through to today. I'm always around the Hill. you know, we went from an inspector general that was very quiet and did lots of audits that never saw the light of day. You know, they were mailed mm-hmm. over to Congress, to one that actually was moving the policy discussion. The, you know, the Postal Service Inspector General actually created a small think tank, brought in some really great nerds with great quant skills and other stuff, and started writing white papers on fascinating aspects of postal operations. None of that would have happened without that direct budget submission.
Another issue that fascinates me with like transparency and oversight and whatnot is the Freedom of Information Act or FOIA. Are you familiar at all with like the claims of deliberative process privilege and how often they use like the exemption 5 so that they don't have to disclose their records, or is this something you're unfamiliar with?
You know, and certainly the and FOIA applies to the executive branch and but not for Congress. you can't FOIA.
Do you think it should?
You can't FOIA your members a member of Congress. I think that would create a real capacity problem. Number one, like how would the legislative branch handle all those requests? And number two, like where do you draw the line? Like, do you get to see every email your member of Congress sends? You know, every text. Like, what? I think it would get very messy, and it'd be a lot to implement. So no, I'm not really worried about Congress being insufficiently transparent. Paradoxically, one of the things I'm concerned about is congressional committees and the hearings being too transparent.
It's being televised and whatnot.
Yeah. You know, on the one hand, like, of course we would like to know what's going on inside committees. We've always wanted to know what's going on inside committees. But committee hearings are too often these days devolved into these paper television exercises. You know, people are fundraising while sitting on the dais because, like, well, if you act all crazy and, you know, wave papers or hold up a crazy sign, people will clip that, put it out there on Twitter, and next thing you know, a PAC is using it to raise, like, wait a minute, this is not oversight. This is not policymaking. What are we doing?
Yeah. Going back to the big picture, can you briefly talk about the four criterion that you use in the beginning of your book to evaluate legislatures?
Oh boy, that's a great question. What were the four criteria that we used to evaluate the legislature? Oh man.
You had oversight, you had responsiveness.
Here. Yeah.
Representativeness, responsiveness, deliberativeness, and oversight. The main criticism I would have is representativeness and responsiveness seem kind of similar to me. You list representativeness as, quote, how well does Congress represent the diversity of interests in society and ensure their equal opportunities to influence in the policy process? And then you list responsiveness as how congruent are congressional agenda priorities and the priorities of the public at large.
Yeah, those are kind of classic political science metrics for Congress, but they're absolutely contestable. You know, one of the best criticisms I've heard of, you know, congressional responsiveness is that, oh no, Congress right now is just too responsive. And they're way too responsive to the most politically active people. You know, this is why you have so many members of Congress acting in a highly partisan way and not actually trying to move policy, because what they're trying to do is to respond to partisan media, whose favor they want to curry, funders, and, you know, their most rabid supporters back in their districts. So how responsive do you really want Congress to be? Maybe it'd be better if they were a little less responsive. But the flip side of that, obviously, is the old charge about, you know, the problem of pluralism, which is that, you know, we've got a diverse society. We want Congress to respond to the full diversity, but different parts of that diversity have more resources and are better able to communicate and get their point across to Congress. So pluralism has this kind of elitist effect that, you know, has been hard to overcome. I don't think we've figured out a way to do that. We try to open up Congress increasingly, and, you know, still the kind of most potent interests, whether they're bankers or unions, are still at the head of the line when it comes to policymaking, because they've got the money, they've got the access, they've got the expertise. And, you know, one thing, when we did our survey and we looked at who works as congressional staff, we noticed that the demography was way out of line with the United States. You know, there are kind of pipelines from certain places to Capitol Hill. And with those people come a certain limited set of experiences and perspectives. You know, so racially, the place has long been out of kilter. You know, LGBT stuff, it's long been out of kilter. It's had a heavy, you know, East Coast bias. There are particular colleges that are overrepresented. And it does have downstream effects, because fairly frequently people who used to work as staff or worked as interns on Capitol Hill end up becoming members of Congress.
Yeah.
And so that's a representativeness issue.
So briefly talking about that congressional capacity survey you had, could you just briefly explain what it was, how it worked out? And then I guess my one question would be, was there any results from the survey that surprised you or not?
Yeah, so the survey was a survey an online survey we pushed out. I should say we did a survey and we also did interviews, in-person interviews. This was all pre-COVID. And the survey was a complex instrument that we put together that required those who took it to spend around a half an hour. And it tested all sorts of stuff. I mean, it asked basic questions about how long they'd been on the Hill and, you know, race and, you know, age and all that sort of stuff. But it also asked them questions about, like, do you think Congress has the resources it needs? It tested them on their knowledge of certain bits of legislative procedure. It quizzed them on issue areas that they worked on. It asked them about, you know, how much are their, you know, do they do work in communications for their member, which we then, you know, mapped to their position. And that gets to one of the surprising findings, was not only is it that the case that a higher percentage of congressional staff work in communications positions, but even those in non-communications positions tend to do a significant amount of communications, which...
Don't some congressmen and women at this point not even have policy staff? I think Matt Gaetz or Madison Cawthorn said they're just closing up their policy shops completely.
Allocate more of your people to the home district to do constituent response work, and then put a higher percentage of them on doing communications related stuff. And basically just don't operate on the assumption that you're going to be a policymaker. That is a rational choice that some members of Congress have made, unfortunately. Another thing that was really surprising in the survey to us was when you asked legislative staff about trusted sources for information, and we asked them, like, do you trust the administration? Do you trust, you know, these particular media? Do you trust interest groups? what came out on top actually was the legislative branch support agencies, CRS, GAO, CBO.
CRS very reliable when I was researching, so I have to say I agree with them on that one. All right, when do you think then congressional capacity reached its high watermark in comparison to the capacity and resources of lobbyists in the executive branch? And then how can we draw upon that historical example as a model for the future?
Yeah, I would say it was in the mid-1980s. You know, you had an escalation in number of committee staff that began around, I mean, committee staff grew over the course of the whole 20th century, but after around 1970, 75, committee staff started really climbing in numbers. And the number of legislative branch support agency staff started climbing in numbers. At the same time, this was still pre-internet. And that's important because the number of communications that legislators got was significantly lower, because you literally had to type and mail something to your member of Congress or give that person, you know, a call. And this again was before, you know, this is back when long distance cost money. You know, it's hard to, for a lot of people who are, you know, not 50 years old like me, but yeah, it used to, you had local calls were at one price, long distance calls were at a much higher price. And a lot of people just wouldn't make long distance calls. So like calling your member of Congress was not something a lot of people would do. So that was kind of a sweet spot. You had a lot more staff available, but you didn't have the demands being created by the internet. You didn't have the distractions being created by the internet. Congress had not slid into the fully kind of war of one party against the other entirely. You know, it wasn't until 94 that Republicans were able to take the House. And, you know, and that, ever since that moment in time, an inordinate amount of legislators' time from 94 forward is devoted to running for the next election, because it's an existential threat that you can get beat. You know, before 94, it was just not that real to them. And so they just didn't put as much time in. And so I think that was the sweet spot, but that was also the seeds of the destruction. Because when you had this massive increase in hiring on Capitol Hill, you didn't have in place a lot of good management systems. You know, you had a bunch of legislators who some were good at managing, others were not. And it got out of control. And it got out of control, and that's what kind of fed the early 90s push to cut staff.
Since the CBO Act of 1974 was the last big bill, or it might just be the last bill period that Congress passed on budget reforms, what new changes do you think should be made for how we pass budgets?
I mean, I think the entire incentive system is all out of whack right now. And that's why we've devolved to this point where we're just, the budget process is simply coping. You know, let's avoid a shutdown. That's like the main goal. Let's avoid a shutdown, which means you're probably going to ball a whole bunch of bills together, you know, close to the deadline of the expiration of appropriations. And that's going to force people into a tough position to vote for, you know, vote for the bill and pass it. And I think, you know, James Madison said the power of the purse was the most efficacious and powerful sort of power a legislator could have. And like breaking that power up, which has gotten all balled up in an unhealthy way, so that more individual members, you know, within committees can exert that would be healthy. You know, you talk to legislators on Capitol Hill and their staff, it's very rare to find any of them who feel like they have any control over spending. You know, they're presented with bills like fait accompli, and like, well, you know, either I can vote against it to stand with my party, or, you know, I'll vote for it, but I don't have a real say on the content. And I would love to see a system set up where the bills are broken up into at least a dozen. We're supposed to have a dozen, but we'd have at least that. And that, you know, committee should be incentivized whereby if you're an appropriation committee and you get your bill ready, you should have some sort of like first privilege on the calendar to get your bill voted upon. You know, but right now, it's not the way it works. Again, everything stops at the speaker's desk.
Bills and those type of things myself. What would you say is your affirmative case for earmarks, and how would you reply to criticisms of the new push for this by people who say it would promote inefficient spending or lead to corruption?
Yeah. You know, look, we all know that legislators right now feel like they're in these kind of this highly polarized environment where they're expected to kind of vote the party line, even if the bill's a good bill. You know, we just saw that with the last COVID bill that was pushed through the Senate. You know, you had at least one Republican who got the bill amended and then subsequently voted against the bill as a whole. Well, why? Well, you know, we have to look like we're part of the team. Well, what if individual legislators had an incentive other than voting with the team? Well, how can we create that? Okay, well, you can give them earmarks. You can give them an ability to put something in a bill that does something useful for the people back home. And, you know, that gives them at least a choice between ideology and some transactional.
Yeah, I forget the quote right now, but you had some great quote from James Madison about the interests of the legislature has to be matched to the place or something.
Yeah. Madison was famous for saying, like, if you expect people to govern to be angels, you're kidding yourself. You know, we can't expect men to be angels. But rather, you know, you have to accept that people are going to be selfish and have, less than high-minded motives frequently, like the public interest as a whole as a high-minded motive. Yeah, sometimes they'll do the high-minded motive thing, but mostly people are going to operate on lower motives, like I want to get reelected, I want to please the people back home. And connecting the interest of the individual to the constitutional privileges of the office, that's the trick. That's the trick. And earmarks are exactly that. And that's why we've had legislative directed spending since Congress was created in 1789.
If you could have any power, or if you could have the power to enact any reform for Congress, what one do you think you'd choose and why?
The one reform I would choose is that it would be set in stone in both chambers that the majority leader in the Senate and the speaker in the House, their roles would be reduced to something like a coordinating clerk. No longer would this person be looked upon as the head of the party, a mini president of sort. No longer would they have, so much ability to decide what the agenda is and, be these giant fundraising machines. They would be much more of kind of first among equals. And if you had that, you would have a much more pluralistic, interesting Congress.
Fair enough. For the listeners, what three books would you recommend to somebody who is interested either in Congress specifically or a system of government and political science in general? And sadly, you can't use your own book.
Oh, no, I wouldn't think of it. So Congress or political science in general. Wow, there's so many great ones. One book I would suggest is Donald Wolfenberger's Changing Cultures in Congress. Don spent better part of three decades on the Hill, and he's a super smart guy. And he's kind of steeped in political science literature, but he had the real world lived experience of the personalities and the power plays and everything. And his book basically shows how the House of Representatives shifted over a 40-year period or so from a place where the rules were structured in a way that they kind of encouraged a collegial brokering of interest between the majority and the minority to just a place where it's all about power plays. And it just reminds you of the importance of rules in affecting how an institution behaves. So certainly that would be one. Another book that I'd represent, that I would recommend, is Fergus Bordowich's book, Congress at War. It's a history and it focuses on the Civil War period. And it's wonderful in so many ways, not least of which is it shows how Congress pushed Lincoln to go bigger on civil rights, on taking the fight to the South. And it shows a Congress that is so different from what we see today. It's a Congress that was aggressive in oversight and policymaking. It was a Congress that believed it was superior to the presidency, which is kind of inconceivable to the modern mind, but that's what Congress was supposed to be. So that would be another one. The third one would probably be the classic by E. Schatzsnyder, The Semi-Sovereign Public, A Realist View of Democracy, I believe is the subtitle. And it's just so good in so many ways. It's an old book, but it just kind of sobers you up as to any romantic views you may have of how the system is supposed to work. And it kind of keys your eyes on the various kind of interesting little dynamics that can happen within a legislature, like, you know, widening the scope of conflict. You know, it's one thing if only five people are discussing an issue, there's a chance that they might be able to broker out a deal. When you add other people in, it's going to change that dynamic and it can make it harder or it can make it potentially easier. There's so much of that sort of stuff in there. And it's a classic. It's well worth it.
Those sound like some great choices. I'll definitely have to check them out. It was a real pleasure to dive deep into Congress today. Thank you so much for your time, Mr. Kozar.
Thank you.